Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Martin Willis, your host, and we have a great show with you. You know, I just bought a brand new, pretty expensive pad. It's called something pad from Apple for my Mac, and it just Bluetooth. It just froze when I'm trying to start the show here, so I apologize for those listening live. My name is Martin Willis. I'm your host, and our guest this evening is longtime UFO researcher Nigel Watson. He's from the UK, staying up late tonight to discuss his new book, Captured by Aliens, History and Analysis of American Abduction Claims, and he's going to be talking about much more. He has other books. He's been around, like I say, a long time, since all the way back in the 1970s. And so it will be, I'm saying he's been researching the topic, that is, since then. So it'll be great to talk to him about all of that. Hey, guess what? I have Alejandro Rojas coming up for a few minutes. And after I get done chatting away here. And first of all, I have to say that I am happy that I have actually sold some paintings to some of my listeners. I had three UFO, triangle UFO paintings, and they actually sold off onto triangle destinations. One to New York, Bill, that helps out with the show. Another triangle went up to Iceland, and the other one's on the way to the UK. So I'm actually working on an underwater USO painting, two USOs underwater, going one going into a cave. I know that sounds pretty mysterious, doesn't it? I'm going to try to make that look pretty interesting. So my art website banner is on, and that's martinwillisart.com, by the way. And that's actually on the sidebar of podcastufo.com. So while you're over there, you can check out this week's blog by Charles Lear. And the name of that is Leonard Stringfield and the UFO Vortex. Also, while you're there, there's a link to our Facebook page. You can check that out. There's 20 some odd thousand people active on the Facebook page. And Peggy helps with that, puts new stories up just about every single day, space related or UFO related. So I encourage you to click like on that page. Anyone can support the show. And I really do want to thank each and every one of you that help out. We are on Patreon, and that link is found also on our website. And thanks to anyone that listens to the show. Of course, I don't want to be talking to myself. It's, believe me, it's not pretty. So I thank you all for listening. I really do appreciate it. And for right now, we're going to bring in the one and only Alejandro Rojas. And let me just bring him on in. Alejandro, how are you? Whoops, I'm just not hearing you, man. We can't hear you.
Oh, you can't hear me?
Thank you very much. Yeah, you really like to add just a little bit of stress, don't you, buddy?
I kind of mess with you a little bit.
Yeah, I know. That's what I had someone write me from actually San Rafael, California. And I'll say hi to Sarah out there. And I used to live in San Rafael. And she listens to the show and she said, I really enjoyed Alejandro picking on you. I believe it was her. It was either her or someone else. So yeah, you do a pretty good job at that.
It's pretty fun. Sorry, buddy, but
that's all right. I'll get you.
You seem to have fun, and you do get me
every once in a while. Yeah. So anyway, what's going on? I would like to make an announcement that involves us. I'm helping you out with your show. You're back. Oh, yeah. Your podcast every week. So, yeah. and it's kind of long form. It's not the old, 25 minutes or whatever it used to be now, where we go like almost an hour sometimes, right?
Yeah, you're on longer. So essentially what I'm doing is, for those of you who missed the podcast and did not realize that the podcast is back, Open Mind UFO Radio is back. But essentially I'm doing it, I'm like Martin. Martin convinced me that I need to charge people. He's always told me, don't give those people so much free stuff. Just kidding. But he has, we do often talk, how do we afford this and how do we keep going? doing this stuff when it's so expensive and difficult. So I have begun to charge for something. So the Friday newscast, where I have go over the news of the week, is Open Mind UFO Radio. And I have a guest with me, usually Martin. At least last time it was, I had Lee Spiegel. But hopefully, yeah, Martin, if you could do Friday, we could do that again.
Yeah, we'll talk about it after. See, how would you do the rest of tonight?
So that's what's going on with that. But then I also have the Rojas Report, and that's where I do my interviews. I share analysis and or do reports. So, for example, tonight, actually, at 7 p.m., I'm doing a report on Spielberg and UFOs, although this is going to be for Phoenix MUFON. So this is going to be shared for free to everybody. So if you can make it, you can do that at the Open Mind YouTube page or at the Phoenix MUFON Facebook page. I'll be streaming that. Otherwise, I've had Brian Bender from Politico. I've had Colonel John Alexander. I've had Chris Mellon of To the Stars, pretty much the man of the hour, the guy who essentially, I think, probably had the biggest role. I think that undoubtedly had the biggest role in getting the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence to request from various different intelligence agencies a UAP report. And in doing so, essentially revealed that there is a UAP task force that consists of many different intelligence agencies looking into the UAP situation. So I was very lucky to get that interview with Chris Mellon. I wrote a Den of Geek article focused on how Unidentified Season 2 is coming up. And of course, that started this weekend, but also about the influence that the Unidentified Television show had on getting that Senate decision request, reporting request done. So, and what role, you know, Season 2 will have, which it will have a role. Essentially, Chris Mellon had a whole strategy here that Season 1 and Season 2 play heavily into the show. So yeah, that's essentially, I've got lots of great interviews. I should have Lou on. And if you're a member of my Patreon, you can join live and ask Lou Elizondo questions. So we're scheduling that now. Hopefully that'll be this week, but it might be next. As soon as we can, I can get that nailed down. We'll let you know. But otherwise, yeah, I've got a lot of great interviews and analysis coming up.
You know, I made this mistake of going on Facebook. I don't think I'm going to do that as much. But anyway, I went on in one of the groups, and someone wrote, I think it was Kurt Collins, wrote something like, "Hey, so what did everyone think of episode one, season two of Unidentified?" And I wrote, "I loved it," because I did love it. And I think I wrote something like, "What's not to like about it?" And you can't believe the negatives people are saying, like, "Hey, we just want to see, you know, real new videos. And, you know, what's up with that? We need to see the real videos." And one other person said it was a dud. You know, unless my senses are completely wrong, I thought it was a great show. Because they're first time stories. The production was really high, production value. So anyway, that's kind of just my thoughts.
I agree on everything that you just said there. There have been a couple people who are in the field who kind of who I respect, who have had the criticism that, you know, we don't need to see clips and bits from the Nimitz events again. We're aware of it. But I think, first of all, they're building on that. You know, they're building on this investigation that is kind of the backbone of this investigation, is what happened with Nimitz and the Tic Tac UFOs. So that's why that plays a part. And we have to remember, you know, it's something that I do on my show and I do here with you, is every time we mention something, a case or something, I try to remember to also give the background. For many of our listeners who have heard these stories, it's kind of boring to them because they're like, "I know what Rendlesham Forest is. I know what, you know, this or that is." But of course, there's so many new people coming into all of this. That's why we need to explain it all. And so I don't mind that so much. I can see how people familiar with the Nimitz situation would get bored with seeing that over and over again. But that's the only real criticism I've heard from some of the old timers, or at least some of the people that didn't love it like you and I. But you know what? When you go on social media, there's always going to be so much hate and nobody's going to be satisfied. So I think that people don't appreciate how difficult. I mean, there's a whole history on how those videos got out. And it essentially came down to luck that they were released when they weren't supposed to be, not by Elizondo. He got permission, but who he got permission from didn't follow all the steps. So imagine where we would have been if we didn't have those videos in the public
to support
this effort.
Did you hear, is this a rumor that those, that at least one of the videos came out in Germany from a private contractor or something? Did you hear about that?
It didn't come out in Germany. What had happened was when the video came out, there was someone who, it ended up, you know, one of the places where it was housed was on a server for a German company that does film work, including some CGI stuff.
So I see.
That had some doubt. But really, it seems as though, and the consensus is, and this seems accurate, that it was someone who worked for that company who downloaded that video and put it on their public FTP server. So really, they say a lot of people had access to this FTP server that they offered for people to use, their clients, or, you know, to share files back and forth. So it wasn't surprising to them that, you know, they weren't aware that that file was there. They weren't sure if it was a previous employee that had put it there or who had put it there, but the owners of the company were not aware that it was even on their servers. And in fact, we have an article on Open Minds from a German researcher who spoke with that company, and others who have followed up on that have found the same thing. So that was a controversy about that part. However, you know, it first appeared on Above Top Secret, the forum, and it seems that someone who had access to actually went on board, probably the Princeton or one of the aircraft or the ships that had that in their computers and downloaded that, accessed it. So the process of accessing and downloading it and sharing it publicly is certainly, you know, something that wasn't supposed to have been done. But it doesn't appear as though there's an ongoing investigation. There could be. So I'm not sure if that person will get in trouble. I've heard that the case is closed. They're not sure who shared it, and they're going to leave it at that. But we'll see.
Okay. One thing I did want to mention to everybody from last week, and that is, as you know, I was speaking with Don Schmidt, and all of a sudden he vanished. He just like vanished in his phone. When I dialed it during a break, it came up that the number was not a working number. So I tried everything to reach him. And the next day he sent me an email. He did respond to me, but it went to my spam box. So one thing after another. But anyway, Don is doing just fine. I just wanted to tell everyone what happened was live during, it was a hot day where he lives, and live during the show, lightning struck a transformer down the road from him. His phone and everything is hooked into this, to his Wi-Fi and all that. So he lost everything until the next morning and couldn't communicate with anybody. So Don is fine. And I invited him to come back on by himself. He's coming back on the 28th, coming up in a few weeks. So I just wanted to make sure because people were very concerned, of course.
Yeah. Looks like some people in the chat were afraid he was abducted.
Yeah. That came up quite a bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's pretty funny. All right, Alejandro. Well, all right. I'll be talking to you this Friday on your show.
Yeah. And if I could share one more thing,
you bet.
Something else that you'll be participating in that you always participate in, which is great. I've got to mention this for my significant other, which is that the UFO Congress, UFOCongress.com, the registration for tickets is open. It'll be a live stream event, so you'll be safe at home. But the tool that we're going to be using, once you go get your tickets, you're going to be able to enter this tool and kind of see all this really cool functionality where you can communicate and have these forums and group chats with other people and all of this sort of thing. But of course, you can also see the excellent lineup that is forming. In fact, the lineup will be completed here very soon. but you'll see most of the speakers up there. So really cool. So UFOCongress.com to check that out, to go get your tickets, to be sure to join us, but also to see all of the people who will be speaking. And there are some really good ones.
Okay. I do have to just gently address something just real quickly, because I've got so much response about this. Something terrible did happen involving a member of MUFON, and I'm not going to discuss it. That's all I'm going to say live right now. I don't want to give it any airtime. It's terrible, and I'm just going to leave it at that, but I just want everyone in the chat to know that I'm not going to discuss it. So anyway, Alejandro, thank you so much. And to leave on a good note, thank you, and I'll be looking forward to talking to you this coming Friday, as always. It's always a lot of fun.
All right. Thank you so much. Talk to you later.
All right. You bet. Take care. All right, everyone. So our guest this evening, we have Nigel Watson. And like I said before, he's a longtime UFO investigator. All the way back, he's been investigating sightings all the way back into the 1970s. And he's published articles in the Fortean, Times, Fate, Flying Saucer, Review, Magonia, and UFO Magazine. And also, he's the author of a book we're going to be talking about this evening. And the name of that book is called Captured by Aliens, A History and Analysis of American Abduction Claims. And of course, we'll be discussing much more. Nigel, welcome to the show.
Hello. Good to be here.
Yes. What time is it there?
20 past 11 at night. So
it's not that bad. Yeah. I always get a kick out when people do coast to coast and they're in England. It's like, 4 o'clock in the morning or something like that. Terrible.
Yeah. So. Yeah. I did one the other week and it was like 3 a.m. in the morning. So remember to bed before or after the event.
Oh, geez. Yeah. Yeah. But thank you for being willing to, be on. You have a reputation of someone that does some really good research over the years. So I want to ask you right off the bat, what made you decide to write this book on American abductions?
Mainly because it was a subject that came up in the 1980s with Bud Hopkins and David Jacobs and people like that who wrote best-selling books about alien abductions. And the whole subject took off in popular imagination as well, with the X-Files being very popular. And I kind of was more an observer of those investigations and things going on. And it was only in the last sort of 10 or 15 years I thought it would be worth looking back at how that research came about and what relevance it is today. And Captured by Aliens is something I sort of started on quite a long time ago, and I just started off with a few notes and observations about it. The most intriguing thing about it is most of the major events in ufology always seem to grow in the United States. You've got Roswell and even Rendlesham Forest and those U.S. Military personnel. So, that's what made me. So I think it'd be great to look back at abduction research after, the dust had settled, basically.
Yeah, I know. Well, getting a little bit of feedback coming through. I know there's the Warminster, what used to be called the Warminster Monster or something like that, but
Warminster thing,
that's what it was. Yeah. I've talked to a number of people in the UK and they say that, there aren't as many sightings in particular because of the weather. Does that play a key factor in your opinion?
Well, where I live in Plymouth, the weather can be very changeable. It can be sunny in the morning, rain in the evening, and sunny again, an hour or two later. So I suppose weather conditions can be very variable. But Warminster's a brilliant place because there's so many hilltops nearby, and Cradle Hill was the most popular site for people to go to look at UFOs. Mainly this all came about in the 1960s, something like 1965, I think, was the year it all kicked off. And then, you know, it was easy to go up this lane and then go over a sort of five-bar gate and up a little track. And at its peak, I think a few hundred people went there. I sort of went there in the early 70s when it got a lot quieter. And so it seems like I always turn up a few years late, really. But, yeah. You know, there's still quite a few interesting people about you could speak to and reminisce about what happened there. And we went up there and we saw a few strange lights and things, but the trouble is there were quite a lot of military camps and exercises going on in the area. So we did see some lights in the sky, but we kind of concluded there were sort of searchlights and flares. But because there are, at night time, there are hills in the distance that you can't see and there are roads on them, sometimes traffic and car headlights can make it look like the lights, you know, flying in the sky when they're really yes. nearby hills.
That so, happens a lot in the mountains and the hills. Yeah. You know, as soon as I said there wasn't a lot of sightings because of the weather, the chat room kind of lit up a little bit. And someone just, let me just see if I can post these pictures up on the site in front of you here. And wasn't there someone posted for sure posted, wasn't there a famous abduction case with three women in England? Are you familiar with that?
I can't think of any offhand, to be honest. I know there have been a few cases involving women in Britain, but abduction cases are fairly rare here because we don't really use hypnotic regression. You know, it was, I think there have been a couple of cases where women were hypnotically regressed and have a kind of traditional abduction event similar to Americans. One piece of research, though, about English cases is that we tend to get tall Nordic-type aliens as opposed to the grey aliens. And, you know, there have been famous cases involving Alan Godfrey, a policeman who came across a landed flying saucer in front of his police car. And then he was hypnotically regressed and recalled being examined inside a flying saucer. And we were like like humanoids with dog-like faces. And, you know, so that was a bit different from the usual type of case. But he was sort of highly traumatized by this incident. And, yeah, it's one of the classic cases, British ufology.
Yeah. Actually, I believe this is the gentleman that bought my triangle UFO painting. in the UK, he says, look up the Falkirk UFO triangle, 1990. Oh, yeah. That was in Scotland.
Yeah, yeah. There were numerous sightings up there in the 1990s, and it was a sort of hotbed of activity. I suppose it became the equivalent of Warminster had been, you know, in the 60s, and there was something called the Bonnie Bridge Triangle. To be an area where a lot of UFOs were seen. And I think a local councillor even said he'd been abducted by aliens and had sort of relationships with aliens. So, you know, quite a lot was going on in the sort of 90s. I suppose a lot of this came about because of, you know, the end of the millennium, really, and things like the X-Files and abductions and everything like that would seem to come into a head. And For some reason, UFO seem to like specific localities, and you know, Warminster, I suppose, is still attractive to ufologists in Britain to go to, even if it's just with a sense of nostalgia. And I suppose Bonnybridge has become the same. And in Scotland, there is a classic case that happened at Livingston, and a man there saw a landed UFO, and these like round objects with spikes came rolling towards him and ripped his trousers, and then he went unconscious. And I don't think there was any abduction recollected by the person, but that was a very unusual case, and there is a book about that by Malcolm Robinson, a British ufologist. So, you know, there are quite a few intriguing cases, but often, you know, a lot of these areas, really, the majority of sightings are of lights in the sky and the occasional contact with perhaps space people and landed craft. But they tend to be in the, you know, minority. But obviously, they're the most interesting cases.
Yeah. You know, I didn't ask you in the beginning, you know, what got you interested in the topic. We can talk about that later. But while we're on the subject of basically what people are claiming abductions right now, I remember speaking with Klaus Fawn from Sweden. He's been on the show a number of times, and he's saying, you know, it's very, very low there. What's it like in where you're from? Do people talk about abductions as much as, or anywhere near as much as they do in the US?
No, I don't think people do. They're more likely just to, you know, mention UFOs in terms of science fiction programs or films. Yeah, and it doesn't really come up much in conversation. Yeah, like I said, because we haven't used hypnotic regression so much as in the United States, that might be one reason why these cases aren't coming up. You know, and perhaps people are reticent about it. And also people are more likely to go on the internet now and put their experiences on social media.
So, true, yeah.
You know, in the past, people had to sort of seek a sort of third party to write up their case or anything, whereas now, you know, we can just put a comment on Facebook. In fact, often you get people mentioning, oh, yeah, I had an abduction several years ago or something. But, you know, there are often they're just off-the-cuff remarks, and they've never really been, you know, interviewed or written down the cases in any detail. So that might be another reason why, you know, we don't come across so many abduction reports as well. You know?
Right. Well, I think, you know, it's interesting. I don't really know. You know, I have... like I said, when you and I were talking, I was on the fence about, you know, abductions in general, you know, to begin with. And, you know, I just think, you know, I have to have an open mind about it, first of all, because if, you know, definitely there's something going on, we are definitely being visited from, I don't know who we're being visited from, but there's something flying around the skies. And there's a lot of evidence of that. And also, I have to always keep an open mind as well, because if, you know, the nature of exploration is not just, you know, observation from afar, you know, we don't do that. I'm not saying that we can expect whatever it is to be like us, but still, it's possible these things are happening, you know, but I did think it was... I always thought it was very strange that it was so much in the U.S. compared to other places.
Yeah. It's interesting, though, that in the sort of 1950s, when the kind of subject took hold, the scientific ufologists wanted to just pin it down to remote-controlled craft, and that there were just, you know, objects that were probing us and investigating us, a bit like the probes we were sending to the moon and Mars and Venus. And there wasn't really that much talk about alien entities. The contactees spoke about them a lot, and people like Jack Adamski was regularly meeting them in, you know, diners and cafes and places. And because they got so much publicity, scientific ufologists and people like Donald Kehoe were trying to promote the idea that these were space probes that were sort of probing and investigating us in the same way we were probing our own solar system. And that seemed quite logical, really. But then I suppose with the Betty and Barney Hill case and a few other cases that are very similar to it, that kind of put the cat amongst the pigeons, really, and people then thought, well, if it's logical that these are extraterrestrial craft, then another step of logic is that, you know, they're being piloted by something, you know, and not just remote controlled objects. So, you know, it became a bit more credible that there might be aliens inside them. And then, you know, another credibility leap was to think, well, perhaps they really are abducting people to carry out research into human beings as well as surveying our planet. So, you know, I suppose by the 1970s, abduction cases began to take root within, you know, more sensible ufology beyond the contactee area. So, you know, it was kind of a slow tradition, really, transition, really. And groups like NICAP were set against abductions, really. But when faced with a Betty and Barney Hill case, I think they felt that this was something more than just a fantasy. And, you know, it kind of opened the floodgates and for it to be acceptable within ufology.
Right. speaking of the Betty and Barney Hill case, is that one you spent a lot of time on looking into over the years?
Yes, I think what struck me was that it was one of the first cases. I don't think it was exactly the first one, but it was one that really took worldwide attention when it was publicized in John Fuller's book, The Interrupted Journey.
Yeah.
And also it kind of has it reflects on modern day ufology. There's still the legacy of that case. And they're very credible witnesses. But also you can track it back in time to the Antonio Villas-Boas case in 1957, where he said he saw a UFO when he was ploughing a field at night. And then a flying saucer landed near him, and then aliens sort of dragged him into his craft. And so that was one of the earlier abduction cases that, although ufologists felt it might have been a fantasy, he was another really credible witness who persisted telling the same story over many years, really. And it might have helped influence the Betty and Barney Hill case, because Walter Webb, one of the investigators of the Hill case, was pretty well aware of Brazilian cases. So I don't know if there might have been a bit of, you know, cross-contamination there. But even so, I think it showed that the Brazilian cases have opened up people's ideas to the possibility of alien abduction. But it's interesting, the Antonio Villas-Boas case, is that he actually had a fight with the aliens and they dragged him on board. And same with Betty and Barney Hill, they were kind of forcibly dragged onto the craft. Whereas in later cases, people are sort of beamed through walls and windows into craft. So either the aliens have had a leap, technological leap, or, you know, perhaps cases like that would have been just totally ignored by ufologists, thinking they were too fantastic. I think it needed people like Bud Hopkins and David Jacobs to, you know, consider the cases from a fresh point of view, and they gave them a sort of legitimacy, and in a way we've still got what they've given to the subject, really, whether you know we agree with it or not.
I was unaware of this 1957 Brazilian case. I just had never heard of it until you just mentioned it. So I'm definitely going to look into that more. But you said that he was forcibly dragged upon a craft, kind of like Betty and Barney.
Yeah, it was an egg-shaped craft. But it was kind of unusual because it had a sort of rudder, I think, at the front or back, and it had sort of little wings, and it had a platform around it. And he was kind of dragged up a little metal ladder. And so it sounds a bit more like a kind of a ship or something rather than anything that can fly very well, let alone be a spaceship. And when he was dragged aboard, he was the aliens had helmets on and everything, and he was put in a room where sort of gas or smoke was injected, and he was sort of forced to have sex with an alien woman. And, you know, this was what really kind of upset ufologists at the time, thinking, you know, this is just some sort of male fantasy or something. But
now I think I've heard about it.
Yeah.
Now that you mentioned that part.
Yeah.
But I didn't realize it was in 57. Yeah.
Yeah. It was not long after the Sputnik launch. So skeptics would say that, you know, space exploration was in the air at the time, and that, you know, Sputnik grabbed the headlines throughout the world. So space. Sure. Issues were in everyone's mind. And also there had been newspaper articles about flying saucers over that period, and that encouraged Antonio Villas-Boas to write to the newspaper about his story. But he never really made any money out of it, and I've read the sad story that he's now buried in an unmarked grave in Brazil, because his family don't want sort of UFO supporters to come and visit his grave. And I think it's rather sad that somebody had such a pivotal role in the evolution of ufology and abduction cases is now, you know, almost like forgotten in his own land. I think that's quite a sad ending, really.
Yeah, that is sad when that happens. And you know, there's been a lot of iconic people, and as a matter of fact, that's what our blogs this last week about Stringfield is you know, addressing that.
Uh-huh.
You know, some of the people from the past that were really, you know, really good researchers. So you were following Bud Hopkins, which I think he did some pretty fascinating work. There's always one case that baffles me because of the witnesses and everything. And you probably heard about the Brooklyn Bridge.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that one is fascinating. Do you know the details of that at all for some of the people that have never heard about that? I know there was some type of celebrity or someone.
Yeah, I think it involved the head of the UN was involved.
Yeah, that's okay.
A woman, I think, was... I think she was sort of levitated out of her apartment window. And it had some connection with the United Nations leader, but I can't remember the exact details of it. Some
ambassador, people, someone wrote.
Yeah, it's getting attacked by flies now. But that was one of the big cases that Hopkins put about. And but some people are sceptical because it paralleled a fictional story. I don't know if it was a story called Nightfall or something like that. But and also it was impossible to track down the people connected with the UN to confirm what this woman said. But apparently there were witnesses to a UFO that night when the woman, I think Linda Napoloni, I think she was called, she was beamed out. And I think some people did report seeing UFO activity at that time. But I think that's a frustrating thing with a lot of these kind of UFO cases where you get a certain amount of detail, but it's very hard to confirm. And also with it being a famous political person, even if it was true, it'd be very hard for them to say that that's what occurred, you know. So I think that's one of the problems of this type of ufology, really. And of course, you know, a lot of the older cases, people are dying off. You know, Betty and Barney Hill are dead, and Antonio Villas-Boas is dead. So we've only got, you know, writings in magazines and a few books, really. So I think it's, you know, current cases we should regard as being more precious, really, before, you know, anything happens to people.
Yeah. Just because I haven't seen your book, haven't read through your book, can you just kind of give a list off the top of your head of some of the cases that you discuss in the book itself?
Well, I do mention the Villas-Boas case and the Betty and Barney Hill case I use for nearly every chapter to look at how it relates back to the past and the future. The Travis Wotan case, which became the subject of Fire in the Sky movie. Whitley Strieber's experiences that he recounts in Communion, and the Pascola, Mississippi case with Hickson and Parker. But what I'm trying to do is put all this material into perspective, really, from a historical point of view, as much as relating the cases themselves. You know, there's plenty of other books that tell us about the cases, but they often neglect looking at different perspectives. Too many UFO books are promoting one viewpoint, you know, they're extraterrestrial or they're ultra-terrestrials or, you know, time travelers, or, you know, usually somebody's got one theory to promote. And I'm trying to look at these cases from different angles, really. And being a British ufologist or a European ufologist, we tend to look at the social and psychological aspects of UFOs, whereas in the States, it tends to be more an extraterrestrial viewpoint. So, you know, I have mentioned quite a few psychological explanations for cases, but what I find a problem is a lot of psychologists mention sleep paralysis as an explanation for abductions, but I think that's we're trying to use one explanation to explain a lot of things. And I think with this subject, from, you know, lights in the sky to abductions, there's never one all-embracing answer to them. You know, there's usually lots of different answers to different cases. So, you know, I think you have to look at every case on its own merits, really, and look at it from a, you know, fresh perspective. And I think with abductions, you know, some might have explanations like hallucinations or fantasies or nightmares and things like that. But others are far more complex and might be, you know, a combination of those things, or, you know, it could be just something really exceptional that is going on, you know. That's the thing that always encourages us to, you know, research and read, really, and that, you know, there's never the ultimate answer.
Yeah. As now, you mentioned the case you looked at, but did you also, have you ever looked into the Allagash incident? I think that's really a fascinating case.
That was like four men, young men who were camping. And yeah. People went out on a boat and had left a fire burning on the shore. I went out on a boat and saw a UFO. And then I think we returned back to shore, and then we found the fire had burnt down a lot further than they had expected. So there was an element of missing time. I think one person sort of denied the validity of their case, but the other three witnesses stuck to their story. And I think they were hypnotically regressed, but I'm not sure. I think they then had sort of classic abduction experiences.
But yeah,
that's one story I didn't mention in the book.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's plenty of them. You can only do so much in a book. Yeah, that I've actually spoken directly to two of the people that were involved in that. That was okay. Yeah, pretty amazing. But getting back, you mentioned the Pascagoula incident, and I just wanted to let the listeners know I spoke with Calvin Parker today, and trying to get, there are two more witnesses that actually, when that whole case gained traction and publicity, there are two people that were able to put themselves exactly that had this experience where they actually saw the craft the same day at a different location, but, you know, going over to that. And I'm trying to get all those people on one of the upcoming shows. Hopefully that'll be within a month or so, we'll have all three people on for one of the shows. Interesting case.
Yeah, because I think the critics said that because it happened near a motorway flyover, that it's surprising that nobody traveling past saw didn't see a UFO or anything. But I think Philip Mantle and Parker himself have found there are people who might have actually seen something on that day or evening, and some were traveling in cars. So perhaps it's just taken a long time for people to realize that, you know, there'd been an abduction at the same time, because I suppose some people might have, you know, not seen the news reports, or I didn't really put any importance on what they saw until a lot later. But it is a bit frustrating when it can take, you know, literally decades to get confirmatory evidence. And I suppose a frustrating thing about this case as well is that Charles Hixon was a main spokesman for the case, and Calvin Parker didn't say anything until recent years. And after the death of Hixon, really. So, you know, I think that tends to happen with a lot of UFO cases involving more than one person, and that, you know, there's always one who's a spokesperson, and then the others tend to fade into the background. You know, like with the Betty and Barney Hill case, you know, Barney wanted to repress it, whereas Betty wanted to talk about it. You know, so there again, it was quite a bit frustrating, really, in that you always seem to get two different characters involved. And I think it's good that Parker's sort of come out and started talking about his experience, because if you look at his testimony, you know, it obviously affected him a lot, and I think he had a nervous breakdown shortly after the case. And also, it's interesting that he was worried about radiation. I think both of them were being exposed to high levels of radiation that might, you know, be very detrimental to their health. And that's one reason why the local Air Force base actually interviewed them, and they didn't detect any radiation on them. But it's quite interesting because Betty Hill also said she reported her experience because she was frightened of radiation. And I think they cleaned out the car or did something where they were quite frightened about that possibility. So being contaminated by whatever they'd encountered showed that was something, it's beyond just our imagination, if you know what I mean. But I felt that something was coming from outside and could affect the health, you know.
Right. I know that they had those circles like on the back of the trunk or something, right, Betty and Barney Hills? Happened to the trunk of the car?
Yeah, we had marks on the car, and I think that he also put a compass on the car and it spun round.
That's right.
That something strange had happened to the magnetic polarity of a car or something. But, it was something she was definitely worried about. And interestingly, it was at a time when I think the Soviet Union was trying to start atomic testing again. So, it's very much in the news that, because it was in the period of a Cold War, that, the nuclear arms race was something on people's minds. And, like the contactees were always speaking to space people who were warning us about, ourselves annihilating our planet and upsetting cosmic balance of things. And so, this is something foremost in people's minds as well. But it's just interesting that two of the most important abduction cases do mention radiation. I think Calvin Parker actually, he was quick to get a shower, really, to kind of clean himself off. I suppose, in a way, that's physically and mentally wanting to, shed the experience, really, and sort of be fresh and new again. So I think, it does show that whatever happened to him and to Betty and Barney Hill did have some, lasting emotional and psychological effects on them. Whatever we think, might have triggered it, were certainly quite powerful events to them.
Right. We're going into break here in just a couple of minutes. The case I think of right off the bat is Rendlesham Forest, when they actually had, traces of radiation. Is that a common, are you aware of, is that a common thing that for like evidence, trace evidence of some landings?
When I first got interested in the subject, we were always, people were getting Geiger counters so that if anyone ever saw landing traces, out would come a Geiger counter. I think it's because there are always stories of, atomic-powered flying saucers, really. So it was a kind of assumption that we use atomic power, and so we would leave traces in the ground. The space gravity and time, I think it was called, or something, was a book by Leonard Cramp, and he spoke about propulsion systems like that, which was very popular in Britain. So it was something people did think about in terms of flying saucers, and I suppose it was logical that they'd use the most modern type of propulsion system. Obviously it was something, at least it was something tangible for you to try and check. Like you say, with Rendlesham Forest, they did have a Geiger counter out to, as we were sort of seeing flying saucers in the sky. So, that implication, really, I suppose.
Yeah. All right. It's time for us to go into break. Yeah, I know Cash Landrum, there was a issue there too.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
We're going to go into the break and hang in on the YouTube. We're going to play Betty Hill for you during this break. So over at KGRA Radio, we'll be back right after these messages.
Betty Hill claims she and her husband Barney were abducted while driving through New Hampshire in 1961. Her full story was only revealed when she was hypnotized. She said a spacecraft blocked the road in front of them. She and Barney were taken aboard by its crew of aliens.
There was one person there who spoke English in a very limited way, who kept trying to reassure us that no harm was going to come to us, They just wanted to do some simple tests. Both of our exams were very similar in most parts, and that they were very interested in our eyes, ears, nose, throat. They took scrapings of our skin, sample of our hair, and are interested in our feet. Then with me, they did what they called testing my nervous system, and he tried to insert a needle-like instrument into my navel, which he called a pregnancy test, and it caused pain, so they stopped doing it. They did not all look alike. They ranged in height probably 4 to 5 feet. As far as appearance, they had no hair and no protruding part of the ear. They had large eyes, small nose, thin slit for a mouth. They were all basically dressed alike in a one-piece dark outfit, but some were wearing jackets, but not all of them. Some were wearing caps, but not all of them. If you've been abducted, you know something unusual has happened, you go to the police. Every real abduction I've worked with has gone directly to the police within 5 hours. And not only that, these people who think they've been abducted and haven't, on real abductions, they always take some possession belonging to the person. About 6 weeks after our abduction, Bonnie and I came home one night, and on the kitchen table was a pile of dry leaves and my blue earrings I was wearing that night. So we knew. They knew where we lived.
All right. Welcome back. This is Martin Willis, and I'm with my guest tonight, Nigel Watson from the UK. And that was quite an interesting clip with Betty. Some things I didn't ever hear. I didn't actually watch that clip. I found it and quickly just loaded it. But had you ever heard of people having things that were missing?
With her case, quite a few spooky things happened to her. I think a neighbor said she saw sort of men in black hanging around her house not long after the incident. And then there's the things about the earrings and the leaves being left on the dining room table or the kitchen table. And, like she says, it was like a marker that the aliens knew where she lived, which is quite chilling, really. And I think Betty went on to have a lot more UFO experiences after that. I think she used to regularly go on sky watches and saw all types of different UFOs. And I think she also saw like pumpkin-headed entities as well. But, most attention has been focused on the abduction incident. Some people think she kind of got a bit carried away with the subject, but she did publish a book which she called UFOs and Common Sense, and in a way she did she was sort of skeptical of a lot of modern day abduction cases, and she hated the fact that some people came up to say they'd seen aliens exactly like the one she'd seen, when really they were describing the sort of modern-day grey type, where she saw more human-looking aliens that weren't anything like the greys, really. Her case was a little bit different from a lot of the cases in the sort of 80s and 90s. And, I think that's why her case is so interesting, because it has so many elements, really. Like missing time and being probed by wires and a needle inserted into a navel. And it seemed like people like Hopkins and Jacobs have said, the aliens seem to be overly interested in sort of reproductive organs, rather than, we never seem interested in our heart or even our brains. We seem to be, which has led some to think that the aliens are sort of trying to breed hybrid babies and things. But, for the Antonia Villas-Boas case and for Betty and Barney Hill case kind of bring those issues into focus, really. But, you know, we're not just even the contactees who were shown around the craft, but they had contact with, like, beautiful space people, and some did say they had relationships with, you know, beautiful space women and things. So, you know, there was that element to it, but they were more like B-movie science fiction sort of stories rather than, you know, the more nightmarish elements of, you know, the Betty and Barney Hill case. You know.
Mm-hmm. That is really something. One of the things she did say, though, she said when she was describing them, is that, you know, she didn't really notice the ears. A lot of people say that about, you know, the grays or other type of things that they see. And also a very small slit for the nose or something like that. Yeah. I think she said something like that. And it's also similar to what people have.
It's also interesting the sort of seem to wear uniforms. And yeah. You know, with the later abduction cases, the spacecraft always seem to be very sterile environments. They never have lounges and TV screens for recreation. But they always seem to be rather code places with examination tables and sort of reception rooms and perhaps control rooms, but very rarely is there something like a cinema room or recreation rooms or anything suggesting that they've got sort of life beyond their mission, if you know what I mean. And I suppose some people think the greys are almost like robots, really, or androids.
The drones, I've heard that.
But yeah. I think with Betty Hill, she had quite a conversation with a leader and other craft, and was a bit of mixture of telepathy and speech. And, you know, she tried to recover a book from the aliens, and she nearly got away with it, but they took it off her before she could take it away. And, you know, that's something like the old fairy stories of the past where somebody goes into an enchanted circle of fairies and is away in fairyland for what they think is only a few minutes or days, and they come back home to find they've been away for years. And they often try and take something from fairyland to prove they've been somewhere different, and it either they stop from doing that, or whatever they retrieve when they get home turns to dust or ashes. So, you know, there are sort of historical aspects of such events. And perhaps it's something that's always happened to humanity, that people believe have been taken away by, you know, aliens or witches or fairies or, you know, some enchanted land. And, you know, it's something that's in our fiction as much as our folklore. And I think with the Betty and Barney Hill UFO, it's quite, you know, a place of examination, and just a control room where Betty saw a famous star map, which has again been, you know, an area of controversy. You know, some people have pointed out it's Zeta Ridiculi, but others have said it might have represented our solar system, and others have said, you know, it's just, you know, because it's recalled from hypnotic regression, it doesn't really have much solid foundation in fact. And I think Shah Valley in particular said, you know, why should advanced space beings have a space chart like that? You know, it's something an old pirate ship might have, but not a modern-day space vehicle. You know, even our own cars have GPS now, and we don't really use maps like we used to. So perhaps this is just an old spaceship.
yeah,
A few star charts there for decoration.
Well, one of the things I was impressed by SETI that they actually did was they actually pointed their telescopes to Zeta Reticuli to see if they could pick any signal up. Speaking of that, I have to mention something because something went wild on social media on the internet a couple of days ago. And because SETI posted on their site, but it was satire, because The Onion wrote that The Onion, which is basically a satire site, wrote an article saying that SETI has been picking up signals every 50 minutes, and it's a classic rock, and it was just this satire. And SETI posted it on their own website as a joke, saying this is on The Onion and all that. So many people took that serious.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable. It was a joke, everybody. So
yeah. I think that's a problem with joking on the internet, is that same with me. You read the headline and then you just sort of gloss over the rest of the text.
Exactly.
And then you think, is that true? And then you go back and read it and you think, it's a made up story or something. And I suppose social media is sort of notorious for that. And, I think quite a few kind of UFO stories do start off as jokes or April Fool things, and then they kind of infiltrate them into ufology until people forget where it originally came from. And then, you have to kind of do a massive a lot of work to find out where it came from.
There's a number of things like that. For instance, Alexander the Great, UFO sighting. Well, there's a lot of people that think that was factual, but when that was deeply researched, it only goes back to, I believe, 1952. It was in a book, and went from there. That's as far back as you can find it. Myth becomes reality a lot of times if the story gets repeated enough. It's unfortunate.
Famous case of British soldiers marching into a cloud and being abducted in the First World War. And, this has been repeated a lot in UFO books and is based on testimony that was given by these Anzac soldiers celebrating the anniversary of the First World War. I think they wrote it in the sort of 1960s and often got repeated. But there were actually soldiers that did go missing in that particular time frame. But after the war, they were actually found in a mass grave. And I think it was a kind of, it was just a collapse of different things, really. The soldiers going missing, and that was a strange cloud in the area. And these two things and the testimony of the Anzac soldiers many years later got conflated until it became a classic story of abduction in the First World War. And that's another example of if you trace it back to its origins, you find there's several different strands to it, really. And then other writers have come along and sort of beefed up the story, and it does sound quite convincing, really, until you kind of look back at it and find out why this story of these disappearing soldiers took so long to become, public knowledge as well. I suppose that's another thing with anything to do with UFOs. That was so much, false information, some of it deliberate and other is just people having fun, really. It's just...
You were talking a while back, you talked about... that it was strange that they knew Betty Hill's location. And this seems to come up sometimes that, but I want to tell just quickly now, I'm doing a book on tape for someone narrating a book that's going to come out. And in it is an abduction story. And I hope I'm not going to get in trouble by telling this, but it's an incredible story where this roommate of this woman who's telling the story, she is in the Caribbean And she comes back and she's totally different. She was only gone a few days. And so that night, that same roommate that came back from the Caribbean asked, she said, "I can't sleep alone. Do you mind if I just stay in your bed?" And she thought it was very peculiar because they weren't really close or anything. And she said, okay. And anyway, three nights or so later was happening, you know, every night she want to go. She felt scared and wanted to be in the bed. So she wakes up in the middle of the night. She sees what she thinks is a hall light on or something. This is not the girl that went to the Caribbean, the roommate, the one telling the story. And she sees like a sliver underneath the door. I guess the door is up quite a bit. And she sees movement. So she realizes, you know, there's only two people in the house. And anyway, so she eventually wakes up her roommate. She said, there's someone in the house. And the girl looks at the door and all of a sudden they see these feet that are floating. You could see through the bottom crack of the door that weren't even touching the ground. And the roommate screamed. Basically, it was an abduction case. She was abducted in the Caribbean, according to her, and with the same beings. And she said they were telepathic and she was scared to death and didn't know how to stop it. And what a scary story that one is. They called the police. The police arrived and, you know, all the lights were off and there was no trace of any break-in or anything. Bizarre. I don't know what's going on, but there's definitely some very strange stories that people are telling.
Yeah, I find that a problem when yeah, it's all right coming up with different theories, you know, like sleep paralysis or hypnosis and hallucinations. But when you actually, you know, speak to people or see them give a testimony on film, you know, like the clip of Betty Hill, you know, it just, they're so convincing, really. And, that, you know, some people might lie about it, but I think people like Betty Hill, you know, genuinely experience something and do quite eloquently tell, you know, what happened to them. And, you know, you can't really just say to them, oh, it's just a fantasy or something. You know, I think that's been, you know, too dismissive. And if it is just a fantasy, you know, why have that sort of fantasy? Why does it have that format? You know, it's a piece of research Eddie Bullard did, who said that looking at a lot of abduction cases, he found that there is a sort of classic scenario of, you know, capture, being probed, and a conversation with the aliens and being returned home. So it seemed to be a sort of classic format to these stories or experiences. And, you know, they often repeat the same themes as well, which is often hard to dismiss unless there's something, you know, some common ground with them that we're missing in being too rational about it. And I think there's something, you know, strange going on, but you know, what it is can be a wide combination of things. And I suppose none of us really have the answers. And, yeah, you know, we just have to keep looking, you know, and be scared sometimes.
Yeah. You know, the people that I've actually talked to, you know, offline, not on a show, sat across from Travis Walton a number of times, had many conversations with him. I don't doubt his story. There's nothing about his story that I doubt. I don't doubt Calvin Parker in any part of the way, you know. And I spent a lot of time with Calvin Parker, and by the way, he came back on this show first. Was the first appearance, and I got him connected with Philip Mantle and the whole thing. So right. Yeah, so I was really glad that. And Calvin keeps telling me, by the way, he says, you know, I'm all done in this thing. I'm not going to talk anymore. And I still get him. He's still going to be on at least one more time anyway. But they're actually making they're making a screenplay of that situation. Mm. So that should be interesting.
Yeah, I think we're also doing, I think, is it a TV series of Betty and Barney Hill case as well?
Oh, yes. That's Bryce Sable. Is coming up.
Okay. So that should be very good as well. there's a very short film called The Brumby Encounter, and that's a very good little story based on the Betty and Barney Hill case. You know, just change the names, but it's set in the 60s, and it focuses on the fact that we're an interracial couple and that Barney's being sort of manhandled by the investigator, who somehow thinks the abduction's a sort of cover-up for him abusing his wife. And, you know, it's quite a neat little story. But if you go back to 1975, and the major UFO incident based on the Betty and Barney Hill case. And that's a very good film about, you know, their relationship and the setting, and isn't so much about the aliens. And, you know, so I think it's really well done for that period, because you could easily go for cheap special effects and, you know, invaders from space and everything, whereas they made it more of a human story. And I'm hoping this TV series will sort of explore those issues, really, because, you know, it's such an important case. And, I didn't like the way Project Blue Book TV series featured their case, and it changed them, the colour of the different characters. And I think we have Barney Hill forcing the investigators to listen to his story at gunpoint, and it just got a bit too ludicrous. I know you can have a bit of artistic license, but, you know, that was of just beyond, you know, they're already fantastic cases, you know, why add such stupidness, really, you know? So I was a bit frustrated about the way they presented it there. So,
yeah, you know, I think I might have missed that episode, or I saw, I do recall something about them going to a big house or something, but I don't remember the details in that particular a Blue Book episode. But I wonder what Kathleen Marden thinks of that particular. She probably get pretty upset about that.
Well, I'm a bit critical of some of the things she says about the Betty and Barney Hill case, even though she's obviously a family relation, so she probably knows far more about, you know, the old dynamics of it anyway, and whatever.
Well, let's hear what that is, if you wouldn't mind.
Well, the evidence is something like, you know, marks on Betty Hill's dress have been, you know, scientifically examined, but I think the trouble is something that's been sitting in somebody's closet for, you know, decades and then subjected to analysis doesn't really, you know, it's just frustrating because it doesn't prove anything, really. And the problem with a lot of scientific analysis is that it doesn't really identify, it might be a bit strange or something, but it can't pin down what that strangeness is. You know, is it just mold or fungi or, you know, whatever, the believers think it's caused by the fact that the dress was touched by the alien hands and they left some sort of oil or substance on the dress. And, you know, like just markings on the car, you know, they don't really add up to anything, really. I think it's like the old thing of abductees trying to get hold of something like a book or a solid object, but never do. But even the landing traces are a bit unspecific. And I think with the Betty and Barney Hill case, there's been a bit of dispute about where the actual landing took place. And, you know, so, you know, it's very hard to pin things down like that, really. And also, you know, even the thing is, it's easy to make fun of psychological explanations, but the human mind is pretty complex, and you know, it can cause real effects on your own body. You know, if you believe, if you've got very negative thoughts, you know, it can have a detrimental effect to your health in reality and not just, you know, a fantasy thing. So, you know, things can be explained by extreme psychological conditions or distressful or strange experiences. So, whereas I think Kathleen is more keen on setting it as something that was something physical and nuts and bolts, but, you know, I might be misquoting her there, but, you know, I think that's why, you know, you get five ufologists and you get five different opinions, really.
Yeah.
The dynamics of it.
Yeah. Well, that happens in anything, really, you know.
Yeah, I see that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's interesting. And what do you think, you know, someone in the chat room a while ago, and a lot of times I can put, you know, I can put things up on the screen so we both can see it, you know, like I can pop that up like that. But anyway, someone said, what about evidence in the chat room? There's not, you know, I mean, what type of, you mentioned earlier that if only, you know, Betty could have grabbed a book, you know, that was supposedly she had in her hands or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, I guess that would be a game changer if we had something that couldn't be explained. But what, besides implants that people claim that they're getting, is, does anybody ever talk about any other type of evidence? You know, I mean, it's kind of like the UFOs. It's hard to gather evidence on, you know, except for video and radar and, you know, but I mean, physical evidence.
Yeah. People have collected alien writing. I think Bud Hopkins in particular did that. I think with the Villas-Boas case and the Betty and Barney Hills case, I saw sort of alien writing, and, you know, different people have used, gone into trances or even done automatic writing, allegedly from alien sources. And we always tend to look like hieroglyphics. And it also links with even Roswell, the sort of strange beams of wood found at a wreckage site.
Yeah.
Allegedly had hieroglyphics on them. So it seems to be a theme of any alien craft seems to have that type of writing above any other sort. So I suppose in a way, I think Bud Hopkins actually kept a booklet of alien writings like that, so that when he came across a new case, he could compare their alien writings with the ones he already had collected. I think there was even a project to investigate alien writings, but I don't think we came to any solid conclusions, really. I suppose it's getting enough of this material to be able to do any analysis on it. And I suppose another thing is, if it is alien, perhaps, you know, it might be so beyond our human comprehension that we'll never, you know, crack the code anyway. And you know, it's also interesting though that with the Betty and Barney Hill case, was some anomalous radar returns that night, but they haven't really got a lot of detail about them, and they were sort of dismissed as sort of radar anomalies. But it's just a bit of a coincidence that happened on the night of their experience. But that seems to be something we always seem to be trying to find any solid evidence, and it seems to be elusive. And that's why, you know, I suppose if you're a believer, you know, you can believe people's testimony, but I suppose if you're a skeptic, there's plenty of room for you just to dismiss it because it doesn't fit in, you know, with nuts and bolts spacecraft or anything like that.
Yeah. I just want to post this up here because I think this gentleman here is making, I believe it's a gentleman, address to, you have to remain agnostic or you'll end up engaging in belief systems.
Mm.
Belief systems. I think that's a really good statement because it's true. We all have to approach this, you know, whatever it is, because, you know, we're not actually going to come up with the answers. I mean, I don't feel we are. And what do you feel about that statement? I think it's a good one myself.
Yeah, I think it's a good one, but I think it's a bit like a Russian doll. There's belief systems and belief systems. So I think you're outside the UFO belief system, but when you get kind of sucked into the kind of skeptic belief system or some, you know, magical belief system or, you know, spiritual one. So in a way, I suppose it's best if you're just aware of these different things. And sometimes, you know, it's with me, because I was originally a kind of believer in UFOs and contact cases, you know, I can look at it from different viewpoints, really. Whereas I think if you've dismissed them as rubbish from the start, you're not really going to enter into this subject. And, you know, there are a lot of wacky things and weird things in this subject. So, you know, I think you've got to be aware of what's going on. And it also, there's lots of different belief groups within ufology. You know, I've mentioned, you know, contactees and abductees, and then there's the scientific ufologists and, you know, more mystical-led ufologists, or, you know, people, I suppose, in European viewpoint, a more psychological and sociological ufologists, you know. So I suppose, in a way, it's just being aware of, you know, different belief systems that are going on, and you know, to embrace them rather than perhaps ignore them sometimes.
Yeah, that's right. I just wanted to let everyone know, and we already have a call coming in. Whoops, it just they just hung up themselves. It looks like a car calling back. So the number is up on the screen in YouTube, but if you're over at KGRA Radio, I think they're having trouble getting through because they hung up twice. But anyway, that number is 855-472-5483. Hopefully it'll work this time.
There's a man in black tapping the lines, I think.
Yeah, it looks like this. It's hanging in there, so that call is going to be ready. And it's Andy who's called a number of times, always has some pretty good points that he makes. And so let me just put you here, and we're going to take Andy on the air in just a second here, as soon as I can move a window over here. Andy, welcome to the show. Andy from Connecticut.
Hi, Martin.
Hey, hi.
My question for Nigel is kind of an easy one for him to answer, I would imagine. What are his thoughts on the fact that, you know, with the abduction phenomenon, it doesn't matter what year it occurs or where in the world it occurs, that the abductee reports generally the same circumstances, the same procedures, and I'd like to hear his thoughts on that. But as always, and I'll listen for the answer off there.
All right, Andy. Thanks for the call.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Hi.
Yeah, like I mentioned before, Eddie Bullard had seen there just seemed to be a kind of template for alien interactions. You know, people are sort of captured and investigated. But I suppose it's a scenario that you might expect, really, from a, you know, if you're beamed aboard a craft, you know, there's only a certain amount of things that might happen to you and then be beamed back. And also a lot of fiction about alien abductions is very similar, perhaps a bit more, it can be more exciting and a bit more detailed, really. Some abduction reports can be, you know, don't have that sort of thrilling element to it that sort of film producers had to them. But yeah, I think also people originally used sort of the Betty and Barney Hill case as a template for their experiences, and then it sort of evolved more into people being beamed aboard and having implants and having suffer from screen memories and different things like that. More elements have been added to abduction stories. So we have changed over time. But it's interesting, same with things like greys. Years ago, nobody ever saw these spindly greys with large eyes. And now, yeah, that seems to be the main sort of alien being that people report. Some people say such things give you a kind of authorized myth, so that if you do have strange experiences, you have a ready-made template to fit those strange experiences into.
I see. Yeah.
You know, like if you see a light in the sky, like now we might at first think, oh, is it an aircraft? Is it a weather balloon? Is it Venus? And then if it does something really weird, we'll think it's, oh, is it a flying saucer? But I suppose in wartime, you'd think, is it an enemy aircraft and it starts shooting at it? Or, you know, is it a sort of illegal flying activities? You know, so, and back in the turn of the, back in 1909 in Britain, people saw phantom airships, which, you know, a lot of them were basically lights in the sky, but people believe there were German Zeppelins coming to, you know, search out the land in preparation for invasion. So what we might experience might be the same, but how we interpret it depends on, you know, the social setting and perhaps on, you know, our own sort of psychological viewpoint as well, you know, how stressed we are and what, you know, whether we're interested in science fiction or not, or, you know, and other aspects of a human condition can affect, you know, how these weird things are interpreted.
Yes. Yeah. We have a caller coming in. I'm just waiting for it to be screened. Yeah, that's all really good points. And hang on, I'm waiting for this thing to be screened. I did mention Bill to screen a little extra. I guess they wanted to talk about something I told them that we can't talk about, so they're gone. So that line is open again. That's 855-472-5483. Not going to bring up the MUFON topic tonight. And so if anyone wants to call about that, that's not going to happen, I'm afraid. I'm sorry. But what do you think about, you know, I mean, we've often talked about, we want, you know, science to take the UFO thing more seriously. And there's kind of a movement in that direction, but you really don't hear anyone talking about the abduction part as far as trying to get more evidence about that. Or do you? Do you ever hear anything about that?
No, because I suppose in a way a lot of the latest things are things, you know, like being filmed by jet fighters and, you know, tic-tac UFOs and things like that. I mean, they don't really seem to fit the abduction scenario. And, you know, one reason might be that, you know, abductions have been actually created by, you know, the CIA to cover other events or to explore the possibilities of, you know, brainwashing in the past. You know, that might be true in some abduction cases, but like with the Betty and Barney Hill case, it seems highly unlikely because they'd gone on their trip to Canada and back almost on a whim. So we'd have had to be constantly tracked by the CIA and, you know, and tracked for, you know, for ages before we could actually, you know, sort of brainwash them into thinking they've been abducted. It just seems a bit outlandish that we'd be able to do it like that. You know, we'd have to be far more organized than to be able to, you know, capture somebody at random, really, like that. You know, I think that's a problem, really, with alien abductions. Is, you know, I suppose alien implants is an area that you might be able to get some evidence, but it seems to be that when this is retrieved, it's very minute material that's gathered, and nobody seems to know whether it's just bodily matter or something that's your body's growing around a sort of a blister or something. So they don't seem to be able to do anything scientifically with any implants if we do get hold of them. I think Willie Strober says that if you do have an implant, when people look again, it's disappeared again. And that's
removed. I've heard that too.
Yeah.
We have. Go ahead. I'm sorry. Did you have a thought? I have a call from Sweden. You ready for that? Okay. We have Andreas from, I probably said your name wrong. It's how it's spelled there. From Sweden, welcome to the show.
Yeah. Oh, thank you.
Go ahead.
Yeah. I have a question. It's more of a... I'm thinking of perhaps you have to be experience a UFO experience to believe it. Seeing is believing, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're following you. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So is this what you want to talk about, a UFO in general, or do you have more to that question?
No, I just think it's a fundamental statement, because many people are curious about UFOs and that, but perhaps maybe you have to see to believe. That's my point.
Yeah, I often say.
So I believe. Okay.
Yeah, I say.
Okay.
Often in Facebook arguments, people talk about government UFO sightings or disclosure, and then they'll say, well, I don't particularly care if the government does just disclose it or not. I've had my UFO experience, and I know what I've seen and experienced, and perhaps on more than one occasion. So in a way, they don't need confirmation from elsewhere. They know it from inside. But, I suppose even quite a few UFO researchers have had experiences which has often led them to become an investigator in the first place. I've seen a few odd things in the sky, but nothing that's convinced me that was anything extraterrestrial or anything, beyond that. So all I can go is by what people say. And, I think, there are a lot of people out there who are, utterly convinced of being, abducted or seeing something genuinely exotic in the sky,
Yeah. Anything else?
You have not, Nigel, you have not experienced UFO.
Well, like I say, I did see something once when I was in Warminster, and I nearly become a believer because it looked so spectacular. But then I heard the engines of it, and it was a sort of one of these Goodyear blimps. So, I could get a feeling of what it would be like if it had been something exotic, really. But I've not experienced anything like that. So, have you had any UFO experiences then of your own?
Yes, I have.
I would like to address something, both Andre and Nigel at this time, and that basically is, I don't think one has to have a UFO experience to take this topic seriously. There's so much out there, and there always has been, that has been really very fascinating and you know, I had an experience, but it doesn't mean anything. You know, the topic has always been there and has captured some people like Stanton Friedman. You know, Stephen Bassett, there's a number of people that say they never had an experience that are really taken seriously, and they look at the topic seriously. There is another podcaster who was on my show in 2013, said he never had a sighting, and now he has his own podcast, and he keeps repeating a sighting that he had as a child. So he made up his sighting, and he talks about it all the time now. He's been on TV and a few other times, but he's always talking about a sighting. But on my show, he said, I never had a sighting when I was a child. I just got interested in the topic because I stumbled into the library. And so now he says he has a sighting because he wants to be more credible. I don't think it has anything to do with being credible myself and looking at this topic.
I think, well, I stumbled into a topic as well through the library, but child experiences or anything like that. And I suppose in a way, perhaps some people do sort of invent a UFO sighting to make it seem more credible. But I think you can study a lot of things without having to have actually experienced them. I think you can have a certain amount of empathy with people, and you know, you just have to bring what you can to the subject. I just find it fascinating, reading about it, talking to people about it, and but it is something that's had a powerful impact on our lives in the last few decades. And I think perhaps, you know, being an experiencer can perhaps colour your viewpoint and perhaps, you know, make you believe other people, even if they might not be fully truthful, you know. And like you say, some people, you know, perhaps who make up things might in time come to believe what they've said anyway. And, you know, who knows really, unless you've got some evidence further back in time. Perhaps that's what happened to a lot of these contactees who made up things and then, come to believe their stories, and often their stories got more fantastic over time. And, you know, I think with, you know, modern media today, there is a big outlet for people to tell their stories, and, TV always likes, new characters and new people who've got amazing stories to tell. But, if you're just more an optimistic skeptic like myself, you know, you kind of don't get that kind of exposure, really.
I like that, optimistic skeptic. We have Brian calling from New Jersey. Brian, welcome to the show.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Good, good.
Great show so far.
Great. You have a question for our guest?
The reason I'm calling in is just to backtrack a bit. You guys were getting into implants, right? And from what I know, the best scientific data that's really been offered so far has been the late Roger Lear.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you guys are familiar with him, but basically, long story short, there was radiometric analysis done on implants that were removed. And according to the readouts, what they were saying was that whatever these things were made out of, that they don't come from our neighborhood of the galaxy. And then besides that, there was basically radio waves emitting from these devices allegedly as well. So just wanted to get your guys, synopsis and opinion on that, and I'll take my answer off the air.
All right, Brian, thanks for the call.
All right.
Implants is something that kind of came up in the 1980s, and Dr. Lear did quite a lot of basic research into this. But, one criticism was that he never got any of this material in peer-reviewed scientific journals, but perhaps because it's such an outlandish thing, perhaps I want to accept it anyway. You know, and some implants have just been of mundane things. Sometimes you can get things under your skin, you know, like bits of metal or something, and you know, could be mistaken for an implant. But you know, some people have postulated implants have been there to sort of guide people and to be communication devices between them and the aliens. And, you know, people have gone to, you know, regard them as quite exotic pieces of technology, perhaps in a way our own, would be beyond our own technological reasoning anyway. I did speak to somebody not that long ago, and he's got an implant and is convinced that it was put inside him by aliens. And he had several sightings when he was a teenager, and that's when he got the implant. And he says whenever he goes to airports, and that is always triggering the metal detectors. But he doesn't. He kind of likes the fact that he's got an implant, but he doesn't want it scientifically examined. You know, he just likes to believe it is an alien implant and that is somebody special, but he doesn't want it to be subjected to any further examination beyond that. And, you know, I suppose in a way, if you wanted to conduct a real scientific study of abductions, you know, implants would be one of the best things to study. But you know, it would be looking at, you know, how do you determine what's you know, alien technology using our own technology? You know, would a Victorian understand what an you know, atomic reactor does, you know?
Yeah. So,
you know, one element of that.
Right, right. You know, getting back to the topic of, you know, the grays, because I think that's another fascinating subject. Because, you know, for instance, the Zimbabwe Ariel School incident, you know, they weren't described at all like that in 1992. They were more like porcelain skin, one with long, strange black hair. You know, the almond, the big oval almond eyes, you know, that's one thing that's mentioned a lot. But I just wanted to ask you this, if you've looked into this part of it, was there ever any grays mentioned before the Whitley Strieber book Communion came out? Do you know?
No, not offhand, but I think you know, different, there were a vast variety of different aliens seen, you know, mainly kind of little dwarfs and Nordic types. And, yeah, I don't really, I'm not really aware of that many greys. I suppose the Betty and Barney Hill case are nearly like the greys, but like Betty said, they're more like human creatures than greys. And I think something like Close Encounters of a Third Kind help establish the sort of vulnerable, sort of large-eyed alien, and you know, that was sort of a bit creepy as well. And you know, I've come across a lot of cases where the aliens are being completely different. It's also interesting, you know, back in the 50s, like with Brazilian cases, but a lot of the entities were in spacesuits, and that was true throughout the sort of 60s and 70s. And then, like, the greys start to need spacesuits. And one case I spoke to a person about was the fact that she said her son saw these aliens come out of a UFO that landed on the roof of a school. But the aliens were like in gold spacesuits with umbilical cords attached to the spaceship, but they didn't have any arms, and so they were quite unusual. You know, they sound like, you know, something like space beings, but, you know, I don't think there's that many reported without arms, and you know, would be a bit difficult to control a spaceship, I should imagine, without them.
But, oh, that's all. It's all telepathy.
Yeah, but you know, there are reports of like aliens that like are faceless, or you know, or look like I said with the Alan Godfrey case, they looked like dog-like entities. So there are. I think if you look back in old UFO books and magazines, the variety of alien types are quite wide ranging, whereas now we kind of conform to greys. And you know, perhaps it's also interesting, like if people recall sightings from decades ago, they tend to report greys, whereas in that actual time period people never reported such things. So it's interesting how people in retrospect could make their stories conform to what we expect now. You know, so, you know, whereas that thing about human memory, really, and, you know, can play tricks on us, and it just shows that the subject does change over time, and, you know, it's never a static thing.
Right, right. And, you know, I mean, there's just so many different, you know, I mean, there's a lot of people that have, you know, besides the grays, of course, if you really look into it, there's people that are saying, you know, the insect, you know, mantis type, and, you know, people are, which I think is another bizarre thing. I don't know what to believe in any of that stuff. It's
the praying mantis type of things are quite intriguing, really, because of symbolically, they're quite a frightening, nightmarish sort of entity. And, you know, I suppose there's no subgenre of people seeing praying mantis-type aliens, and they tend to be quite nightmarish, really. And, you know, there is a sort of symbolism about different entities, like the greys are almost like the you know, how we conceive of hive-like communist types, whereas a praying mantis is more of a...
I'm sorry, the time just snuck up on us here. I'm terribly sorry. We are totally out of time. And thanks so much. We'll be back next week, I believe, with Linda Zimmerman. Good night. Thank you very much.
Okay, good night.
All right. All right, everyone. So see you next week. And remember, thank you for listening, and keep your eyes to the sky.